Serena's phone rang as she opened the front door of her townhouse to go out to take her Doberman for a walk. "Oh, darn," she muttered, fetching it out of her shoulder bag, while commanding the dog to sit, stay. It sat stoically guarding the open door. "Good morning," Alma said. "I'm Delrina North with Dr. Dino Trigliani. He gave you this number?" "Yes, he's keen to wrap up your involvement with Angela and to reward you for your services." "Oh, God," Serena blanched, holding her heart, which was racing. "I'd like to meet with you this morning, if possible, at the Arboretum in, say, half an hour. Can you make it for a walk and talk before work?" "Do I have a choice?" "If not this morning, then another time. Why so worried?" "Jerry McMahon comes to mind." "It will be brief and sweet, I promise." Serena licked her dry lips. "May I bring my dog?" "Certainly. Meet me at the entry to the main parking lot. I have blonde hair and I'll be in a blue coat. I'll know you, of course." Alma drove her host's car and parked near the entrance to the Hoyt Arboretum, an extensive tree garden with miles of trails. She met Serena and her leashed dog, and they were soon on a meandering forest path amidst 2,300 specimens of trees from around the world. Serena peered anxiously in every direction. "No one's with you? No one's following? What makes you think that you'll suffer Jerry McMahon's fate?" "I know what he knows, same as Angela, what she dreams about. He tried to tell the killers again and again that they're just dreams, just some women and a baby. I mean, they're weird and freaky and up to some crazy stuff, but..." "How do you know what he tried to tell the killers?" "The video. I watched it all, like I was told. God, it's so vile." She almost retched. "Ah, I recommended that they spare you, but apparently it was necessary that you see it. I was doing my best, I swear. I didn't need that to... You didn't handle Fran Roma very well." "What, is she with you guys?" "Oh, no," Serena groaned. "No, she's not with us. That was our concern." "How do you know her and me? Have you bugged my office?" Alma said nothing. Serena continued. "She just showed up and threw me for a loop, so I made up a story about Angela and her dreams. Talked dream therapy stuff. I thought I did okay. I mean, I put her off. But then Jerry got killed and I got the video. They're connected, right?" "Nothing you did caused him to be killed, but his death certainly has kept you on track, right up until you hit Angela." Serena looked as if she'd crumple. "After McMahon, God, what a horror. After he died, it got really hard, I mean, because of the way he died, and I also didn't have his dreams anymore, to get Angela to match hers with his. She got really resistant about saying anything." "Did you take notes of her dreams?" "Yes, but I was scared, so I destroyed them all, every bit of paper from notes taken while we talked, and everything I'd transcribed onto my work computer." "Give us the computer, and I'm sure we can find the files. You can't just delete them, you know." "I know that. I totally destroyed everything. I mean, physically destroyed. Nothing left to put back together, to read, nothing." "Ah, that's unfortunate. Jerry got killed for what he'd written, what was on his computer, but then I got thinking that I could be killed for what I didn't have. So before I destroyed it all, I got a new tablet and put all the files on it, codename, transferred to a little USB drive that I smashed to bits, everything's totally password protected, and the tablet's never been on the internet, so nothing's traceable. I've hidden it, I hope, super well." "Good, you have to give it to me. We'll arrange that when we part. Now tell me why you hit Angela." "After Jerry was snuffed, I'll have nightmares about it forever. Angela got more and more stubborn until she refused to tell me anything. I got so stressed, so afraid I'd be next that, well, bang, my own years of abuse." She broke down. "I'm sorry, it's unforgivable. I always thought that I'd rather die than hit a child. Angela is like Jerry was, so protective of the women in her dreams and the baby. Well, who can blame a baby? But the women give me the creeps, all these strange forces, bizarre research, and weird, simultaneous dream stuff. It got McMahon tortured and killed. I'd hate it. It's got to be evil." Alma said, "Well, whatever you think it is, you're finished." Serena's face dropped, gaunt with fear, as in free to go, off the case. Serena stopped and looked at Alma. She blinked several times. "Just like that?" Alma smiled. "Yes, it's obvious you need a break, and I would suggest you get some intensive counseling. I'm here to help you get away and get healthy." Alma checked her watch. "Let's head back." She turned and started retracing their steps. How soon can you pack up and leave town? And I don't mean a short holiday. I mean an extended retreat, at least half a year, or even a permanent relocation. Serena looked confused. I don't know. I mean, my clients, my business. Alma repeated slowly. How soon can you move from town? Day, couple of days, I don't know. I don't have much money. I could get a loan and, well, my colleagues could take over my practice. We've got a holiday arrangement. I don't know about a long retreat. Probably better to just move, family reasons. I'll make up something. This is so crazy. Alma opened her large handbag and withdrew an accordion folder. She opened the flap to reveal a neat, thick stack of new bills. 50,000, all unmarked and untraceable. It's yours. Serena stopped, 2 days to talk for long seconds. Finally, she whispered, how do I know it's not a trap? You're beyond paranoid, poor girl. You've done good work. You've made a couple of mistakes, nothing unforgivable, and now it's time to start over. This is your reward, your freedom. There are a few catches. First, you must use it to go away and look after yourself. Second, you must leave immediately, and I do mean immediately. Third, don't give anyone your forwarding address for at least 6 months if you want to vanish from our radar. You'll be old news and of no interest by then. And finally, I need the tablet. Gladly, she said. Go right from here to wherever it is and package it up. Wrap it and tape it well and mark it with my name, Delrina North. She spelled it out. I'll have a courier pick it up. Text me when it's ready, using the number I called you from. Is an hour enough time? Oh, yes. I'll need the passwords, too, which you can also text. Don't worry, my phone is well proxied. Nothing you send me goes anywhere but to me. And it's disposable, so it's history before today's done. Alma gave Serena the folder full of cash. She said a wary, breathless thank you, then hurried her dog to her car. Raoul drove Larry's sleek, black pearl Jaguar with Larry in the passenger seat to the hospital. As Larry jumped out, Raoul said, don't take a bite of May's food, promise on your life. They had their chance to kill you. I'll bring you a pudding, Larry teased as he got out and closed the door. Blood pudding. Raoul revved the motor and took off into traffic. Larry went directly to where he had visited May the previous evening. Again, someone else was in her bed. At the nursing station, a staff member turned to another and blurted, Mrs. Singer Jones, the morgue, right? Larry blanched. The morgue? What are you talking about? I believe she died early this morning. I wasn't on shift. I'll check. She reviewed a sheet on a clipboard. Yes, she died before the 7:30 shift change. Let's see, pneumonia plus heart failure. She was what, 95? I saw her last night after they'd cleared her lungs. She was sleeping peacefully. Did you talk to her? No, but she was fine, breathing easily. Well, our seniors often just slip away on us. I'm sorry. You're welcome to go to the morgue. Here, I'll give you a guide. She got a brochure, opened it up to the hospital floor plan, and used a pink felt marker to trace a path for Larry to follow. Larry took it, then loudly and in general addressed the nursing station. How did this happen? Why did no one call me? I'm available any time, 24 hours a day. I'm on her chart. I'm her next of kin. Rushing to him, a senior nurse said, shh, please, we're very, very sorry. You don't phone anybody? Just another useless old crone gone? Is that it? I don't know why you weren't contacted. I'll look into it. It doesn't change the fact of the matter, which is that she's gone. To help you deal with it, we have grief counseling, a resident pastor of your religious choice, a formal complaints procedure, and I can certainly go with you to the morgue if you'd like. No, just give me her little pack of possessions and let me out of here. I've had it with hospitals. God help me, you'll never see me in another one again. The senior nurse said, she'll be cremated and her remains. Cremated? It's routine procedure unless noted otherwise. It's all rather well spelled out in our admission. Well, I'm Mr. Otherwise, Larry said. And to hell with your procedures. I've seen enough of them. She's Jewish. It's not on our records. Well, I'm telling you now, or if you've been shaking and baking her already, damn this place. You really must go to the morgue if it's not too late. You have a map. Good. Goodbye, sir. She returned to more pressing business. He looked momentarily abandoned, then pushed himself into gear and numbly followed the pink line to May's tiny, cold corpse. 2 days later, Fran and Larry communed in May's living room, surveying the Herculean task of getting her home and estate in order. "I can't do it," Larry said. "Arranging the funeral service is my limit. You don't know how much I hate this dying stuff, and now the whole messy estate. I mean, I'm getting my business off the ground, and everything's down to the essentials, not an ounce of energy left over to deal with this." "I think it's fascinating," Fran said. "It's like a wild treasure trove, like stumbling into the cave of the Dead Sea Scrolls or something. Look at it. It'll take forever to go through and organize. 50 years so far for May, although she's been independent for the last 20, retired, widowed, and financially secure." "Well, that would be an incentive, not the widowed part, the retired and money thing." Larry looked at Fran, suddenly inspired. "Fran, tell me I'm nuts. If the estate matched your current income, would you be willing to work on this, get it tidied more or less, then come work with me after everything's settled with the Anne? I was talking academically, not realist, so get real on me. What do you think?" With new eyes, Fran looked at May's decades of past work and years yet to do. She blinked, thinking hard. Slowly, she said, "I may regret this, and I'm nuttier than you are, for sure, but yes." Larry's whoop was punctuated by a knock from the brass snake on the front door. He leapt up and welcomed Alma, disguised in a cropped auburn wig and wire-framed glasses. She wore the same blue coat as she wore to meet Serena, carrying the same large canvas bag. They hugged warmly. Alma stuffed her wig into a coat pocket. Larry helped her take off her coat, and as he hung it by the door, said, "Alma, you won't believe it," he grinned. "Fran's agreed to carry on May's work, get it in some kind of order. I'll pay her from the estate. There's enough to keep her going for a few months, at least." "Wonderful!" Alma looked around and took a deep, wistful breath. Hard to believe she's gone. She had so much life, did such important work. "I miss her, Mother and May, both gone so suddenly. Bless you, Fran, for stepping in exactly when we need you most. With Luna, of course, and now with this work." In the living room, all three found seats. Alma continued, "I have access to funds as well, large sums for helping with things like Larry's new venture and for getting Serena's files and helping her vanish." "From where, dare I ask?" Fran said. "Are you free to tell?" Alma shrugged. "Wealthy benefactors, trust funds, other endowments. Money is never a stumbling block, although I have none of my own. We can't afford the profile and risks that personal income, taxes, and such things bring. We contributed to May's upkeep and her employment of Nikos. For continuing her work, there's plenty to keep you going, indefinitely." Fran said, "Indefinitely? Whew! I'm full-time for Luna as long as it takes, that's a given. With luck, she'll be back with her mom real soon, then..." Larry jumped in. "We'll keep Nikos on to help you here, speed things up. He's been itching for years to do some cleaning and painting. Major refurbishing now. He'll love it. In fact, Fran..." Larry looked inspired again. "Uh-oh," she said. "Instead of tending this place and yours while paying to live there, why don't you move in here? I mean, when it's cleaned up. You, Nikos, and Luna to Alma," he said. "What do you think? Would it be safe enough?" May's accident obviously had nothing to do with Pavla's abduction, or the house would have been ransacked and torched by now. And May would have told, of course, if she'd been threatened in any way. Larry groaned. "What horrid thoughts. Who are these god-awful people?" God-awful, yes, working in rigid, predictable ways for God as they see him. "Fran, if you'd like to live here with Luna, I'd say fine. It's as safe a place for her as any. The backyard is especially nice, private, with lots of potential. If she's here long enough to start learning from May's work, that would be a great plus." "Uh-uh," Fran said quickly. "She'll be back with Pavla long before then. Please, please." "And Nikos might not want to," Larry smiled. "Yes, he will. He's our ringer. You're in, sweetheart." Fran laughed. "Got any more plans for the odd 5-10 minutes I might have left over of my life?" Alma said, "Actually, I do. This is nasty business, though. I'm sorry. Serena gave me a video of Jerry McMahon's execution." From her bag, she pulled a small bubble pack envelope. From it, she removed a thumb drive. "I'd like both of you to view it, then treat it as you would any anonymous package, and pass a copy of it on to the appropriate authorities. You'll see that it's a vendetta and a botch-up. Wicked stuff, the worst." She continued, in one of Angela's recent dreams, Trigliani apologized to Pavlov for the fisherman's death and said it was a mistake, but his team still found the recording handy for terrorizing Serena and thus, I suspect, getting the dreams they needed from Angela to zero in on Pavlov. Keep this little drive here, please, for the record, and most gruesome part of our reality. Alma handed the memory stick to Larry. He winced as he took it. Sure. Relieved, Alma said, thank you. From her purse, she then fetched the packaged-up tablet Serena had given her. This has all of Serena's files from sessions with Angela, as well as Jerry McMahon's notes, which I'll leave here. The tablet's never been connected to the internet, and it must stay that way. Now, the good news are as good as it gets. According to Angela, and corroborated by Siddhartan, Pavla and Trigliani are flying and driving together, driving and flying, a long trip in closed transport with unidentifiable transfer points. They could be going in circles, ending up very close to here, or they could be half a world away. As long as Pavla cooperates, Trigliani says she'll be safe. She'll do her utmost, I know, and I have to believe him. I've nothing else to go on. The bad news, however, is that early this morning, she disappeared from Angela's and Sid's dreams, gone black again, and I expect for a long spell. I'm not thinking the worst, however. I'll keep looking for her as long as it takes, as best I can. Pained, Fran asked, what can we do? Larry said, I can put out feelers for you, tap every source I've got in every country. Alma smiled, thanks, I'll remember that, but at this point, it's an inside job, very inside. You're helping plenty already by keeping and loving Luna, arranging May's estate, and forwarding her work. I am deeply grateful. The only way to Pavla now is through Trigliani. I've recruited Rachel Dupont to get as close as she can to him. Email to trigliani@homeport1.com from rdupont@umgen.edu, date March 30th, 1533. Subject, new spin. Dear Dr. Trigliani, major breakthroughs imminent on mitochondrial factors, broad ramifications, contact me ASAP, Dr. Rachel Dupont. A rare pleasure, Dino Trigliani said to Dr. Dupont as she got into his Lamborghini parked in front of her research building near the tree and bench where Fran had interviewed Dr. McElroy. A necessary pleasure, Dupont said in her throaty voice. Let's not gush too conspicuously and ruin our reputation as the best of enemies. Trigliani laughed. This could be like two porcupines mating. Perish the thought, a hedgehog and a porcupine wrestling. Let's hope not mud wrestling, because clarity is key to any partnership. The trick is to proceed carefully. Very. Dupont had her phone's GPS tracking turned on, and Trigliani hadn't asked her before driving off to ditch either the mobile itself or disable the GPS app or the unit's deeper encoding. Apparently, he trusted her that much, which could be a lot, else he had plans to monkey with her phone and ditch it later. As they drove, she memorized every detail of the route that she could and estimated distance by his speed, in case she had to retrace the route by her own measure if need be. Beyond the city limits, Trigliani sped along well over the limit without his radar detector beeping once. He said, you are not famous for sharing. Why now? I am, when I'm certain, then I share with the world. My publication list is shorter than yours, but it's all quality, rock solid. You are saying mine is not? Dupont smiled. Definitely prickly. Have you seen the latest citations index? Of course, I have lots of papers, fewer hits each, on balance, no better or worse than your score. Besides, you are on enough editorial boards to cut me off cold, and you do not. So clearly, I fulfill your minimum requirements, Dupont conceded. You do adequate research, occasionally very good. We might do some notable work together, who knows? Why now? Why this? Dupont shrugged. Funding, facilities, personnel. Trigliani smiled. So you're admitting that I have a few talents in those regards, if not as a scientist. You're a genius at it. If you were any smarter, there wouldn't be a nickel left for the rest of us. I'm at my grant limit, nothing left over to explore these mitochondrial tangents, which could have immense ramifications. All the more reason not to share, Trigliani said. Annoyed, Dupont said, you frustrate me at every turn. I'm not in it entirely for myself, as you are. This is too big and too important to play tight-ass games, okay? Do we talk mitochondrial factors and try to work together, or do we not? Okay, okay. Trigliani slowed and pulled onto a paved single-lane road. As the green rural landscape zipped by, with no standout features easy to remember, Trigliani continued. It might surprise you, but I recently stumbled on the possibility of the mitochondrial connection myself. No wonder you jumped at this meeting, despite playing coy and difficult. And no wonder you've got a secret lab out in the country. It all fits. How did you stumble onto this connection? It's a quantum leap. Luigi Borelli and Henry Krebs. No, they're not that good. I don't believe it. So don't. The thing is, I am on it, and I am going to make something of it. What is your source? This is the difficult part. I've done something unusual for me. It's justifiable, but, well, you'll like this. I'm doing an end run, getting even. Really? This is interesting. Do tell. DuPont sighed, then reluctantly said, Our dear Janet McElroy ripped me off in her last publication after I'd been so good to her. Rather than take her publicly to task, we talked it out, and she appeased me with tidbits of her latest research. I can still mess up her career any time I want, all these editorial board positions. So she's pretty much where I want her. Her work is mind-blowing. I don't know how she made this big jump, but she's got some edge on us that makes me think she's not playing straight. Trigliani smiled slyly. She is not. She has done the impossible. I will tell you later. After several miles on a single-lane highway, Trigliani turned onto a gravel stretch that wound through thick scrub alder. The car bumped, the gravel crunched. DuPont asked, What do you mean, the impossible? Later, if this works out between us, she is in deep with her research, he smiled. Very deep, just a breath away from trouble. I knew it, with her secretive methods, unpredictable appearances, then this latest dirty trick. Well, enough is enough. I'm either going to nail down her research, or I'm just going to nail her. Trigliani smiled and shook his head. I cannot believe it. You are turning human on me. She said, coming from you, I could worry. It's just that, as I get older with less time to waste, I get more practical, less tolerant of bullshit. Trigliani said, I too like to cut to the quick. We might make a great team. He took a hard right onto a narrow, rutted lane which rolled and curved through pleasant woods, then opened suddenly to an impressive estate. A pseudo-old manor rose from the wide meadow dotted with graceful shrubbery, the fieldstone and timber building reflected in a nearby pond. All of the diamond-paned windows had functional shutters, which were closed tight on the ground floor. To one side of the building, a livery wing had six garage doors. One of them opened and swallowed up the Lamborghini. Trigliani led DuPont down a beige corridor with several unmarked doors on each side, leading to a roomy, white and steel laboratory with high ceilings, no windows, and bright, full-spectrum lighting. Well, well, DuPont said, life in the country. Trigliani smiled as she quickly assessed every part of it. Her eyes lit on a large whiteboard filled with writing and diagrams. Shocked, she said, that's Janet's writing. She's been here, you should have told me. Why, showing you is better. She's working with you then, I can't believe it. You and she are underhanded beyond, well, I'm stunned. Practical, as you said, we are all practical. We need her on side with this, and perfectly contained. It's a matter of control, and I have it. So tell her that I've arrived, and I'd like a few words with her. Trigliani shook his head. No, she is not here, not anywhere near here. So where is she? Privileged information. In fact, I am the only one in the world who knows her whereabouts. She may publish as Janet McElroy or Pavla Blanca or any number of other names. She has other? Wow, sneakier than I thought. Many aliases. Trigliani reached into the inside breast pocket of his suit jacket and pulled out Pavla's University of Minnesota business card, the same as the one Fran picked up in Athens. I work with her as Pavla Blanca. He held up the card for Rochelle to read. She reached to take it. No, Trigliani said quickly, putting the card back in his pocket. We will call her Pavla, but I warn you, do not bother trying to trace her by this name or any name. I am telling this to save you a wild goose chase. She is doing highly illicit research, even by our standards, with unbelievable success. We need that research, and she needs cover, so we have made a deal. I keep her in perfect secrecy and safety. She continues her work. We share the results, and, I hope, the substantial fruits of it. We, meaning Borelli and Krebs as well? Yes. Where have you got them hidden? No need, they work here, and they also work at their usual facilities. They are free to come and go, but not to create a traceable word about this, not without running it past me and Pavla. There could be room for you. It depends on what you bring. DuPont laughed. I guarantee that I know more at a glance about what's written on this board than you three put together. I've got a key missing piece, one our dear friend very cleverly left out of this overview. I can save you so much time that the question is there room for Borelli and Krebs? There has to be. They're in already. Too bad. Well, they're harmless, and I presume I can talk to them without these clandestine low-level flights to the boonies. Trigliani laughed. Yes, discretion is advised. I can show you a video recording of what happened to an associate who was indiscreet and uncooperative. My funding source plays hardball. Forget the threats. Who is this funding source? A large corporation with deep roots and deep pockets. A world force and highly respected. I am not at liberty to disclose. You would not want to bring disgrace upon it should we fall afoul of the law. DuPont snorted. Ha! They make nasty videos doing God knows what to whom, and we worry about disgracing them? They're lucky to have you. You're as slick as an eel. I should find that alarming, but it's comforting, actually. Trigliani grinned. He knew, and DuPont guessed, that their every word was being recorded. This last comment would play well to the bosses. She continued, so how do we communicate with Pavla, whoever she is? You communicate through me, only through me. We have a secure setup, and when you are on board, officially, I will get your correspondence to her. No phone calls, Skyping, any real-time connections of any sort. And no trying to outsmart me in this regard. The price could be... Stop it. I have no interest in this cat-and-mouse crap. I'm here to work, not play games. Just tell me, what's this impossible thing she's done? Top secret. Exasperatedly, she said, I am really tiring of this, quite ready to leave with my... Shh, Trigliani lowered his voice dramatically. I'm taking a chance telling you this, a chance to get you on side with me. She has reproduced herself parthenogenetically. The baby is 9 months old now, no anomalies whatever, none. DuPont's eyes popped. No way, no freaking way, are you sure? Absolutely. God help us, if this gets out, well, the publicity will be deadly by association. Who cares that we work with turkeys and mice? We'll be hounded by the news, dogged by the ethical uproar. No wonder she slips around like a fugitive, a criminal. No wonder she's happy in your sweatshop, wherever you've got her. No, no, she's in a beautiful place, an excellent laboratory. Where's the baby? Safe and thriving. Please, no more questions about this. Just tell me what you have to share. DuPont walked to the whiteboard and pointed to the mitochondria. I know how to get you from here to the nucleus like that, she snapped her fingers. Save you years. Trigliani said, give me a hint. Pavla's got the nuclear part figured, making it a fairly quick jaunt for us to get back to the mitochondrial application, assuming we cooperate perfectly, employ impeccable techniques, and lady luck smiles. Without me, you're stalled at square one. I know that. Just give me an appetizer. It's transcriptional, an element you'd never expect. Literally, an element. An enzymatic process at the core of which, yes, is a key element. Trace, I assume. It bridges a fascinating gap. It can be both the needle and the haystack, depending on your perspective and purpose. There's more, of course, but enough detail for now. Whatever else Dr. Pavla is, she's brilliant for having figured this out. You are not going to tell me right now, are you? Of course not. I'm in and we shake, or I'm out and I'm gone. If I'm in, you'll get my preliminary data when you've dropped me off at my office. Trigliani extended his hand and they shook. He lowered his voice. You had better not let me down, DuPont smiled. Sounds like a threat if I didn't know you better. Trigliani smiled in return. You know me well enough. Santu lived in an apartment high above the downtown core. When he worked at Media 8, he walked 3 blocks to the office. Now his commute took 2 minutes by elevator to the 3rd floor of his building, where he and Larry had rented office space for their new headquarters, the bare beginnings of their innovative new reporting service called, with thanks to Clark Kent, the Daily Planet, or TDP, on the web. Until winter, they would work together, getting underway. Then they'd split their time at the helm. From winter to spring, Santu would run the show while Larry retreated to a friend's place on Eleuthera, the Bahamas island whose name means freedom, where he'd start writing his Rosebud blockbuster novel. Santu didn't have plans yet for his summer and fall off, but he was in high demand. Something exciting would come up. "The arrangement is an experiment," a business magazine article quoted Larry saying about his new venture. "With thanks to a fight with cancer for forcing all sorts of creativity, it'll be news-telling like you never knew you wanted until you got on board." TDP offices covered a few thousand square feet of empty, bland walls and carpet. A carpenter and a painter stood in the center of it, conferring over plans to create a bright-colored maze of open and private workspaces, complete with light pipes to keep plants green and employees cheery. An electrician worked at the edges, measuring and calculating a maze of complex circuitry. By a luncheon nook with a fridge sink and the lone table in the place, a graphic artist slash webmaster worked at a computer. Mellow blues and jazz pulsed from her speakers as she designed TDP's website from the ground up, its own proprietary platform, no plugins, widgets, forms, etc. from others. Larry's new desk took a full-windowed corner. He crouched on one knee to assemble cabinets and shelves. Santu carried in boxes of files and books to put in them. Money was too tight during these startup days to hire any but basic help. And besides, both were enjoying these blue jean days and the nuts and bolts, literally, of setting up. They bantered a bit between humming to some of the webmaster's tunes. Just before noon, Fran arrived, carrying Pina Giuseppe's big canvas bag over her shoulder and two bunches of mixed spring flowers. "Hey, Fran, nice surprise," Santu said. "One for each new desk," Fran said, of the bouquets. From the bag, she retrieved two clear glass vases, each wrapped in tissue, which she removed. She filled the vases with water from the sink, then returned to Larry's desk to arrange the blooms. "Nice touch," Larry said. 16 tons to follow." Santu looked puzzled. Fran pulled a white, unmarked envelope from her bag, from which she extracted a memory stick. "You're invited to watch." "In the editing room," Larry said. Voice raised, he said to the others, "Hey guys, lunchtime. Break until 1, okay?" To Santu, he said quietly, "No questions until we're inside. Come on." The editing room held half a dozen chairs, lined up in front of a huge, wall-mounted screen, nothing else. It would soon be crowded with AV editing equipment. The space needed soundproofing yet, but no matter, since any eavesdropping ears had gladly scattered for an hour, at least. They were keeners and worked hard, but they liked their freedom, too. "It's Jerry McMahon, the Nova Scotia fisherman, getting wasted," Larry said, hitting the power button. Fran handed him the thumb drive, which he plugged into an outer edge of the screen. "You're kidding," Santu said, wincing. "Sorry to spring this on you," Fran said, "but forewarning doesn't make it any easier. You certainly don't have to watch if you don't want to." "No, it's okay," Santu said. "Where'd you get it?" "Anonymous drop-off," Larry said. "At least that's the official story when we give it to the CIA. He dropped his voice. "Truth is, it's from Alma, Uncle Sid's new friend." "How's she connected?" "Long story. Jerry McMahon was a survivor like your uncle. He had a rock, too." Santu's eyes widened. "Uncle Sid could be murdered?" "No, McMahon talked. He wrote down his dreams, shared them." "Well, no problem there. Not much nuclear waste dumping in my family." "Actually, we don't think that's what got McMahon killed. The hot rock story might be completely bogus. The CIA may be chasing a lie, and we've got to tell them," Santu said. "So what's the real story? Is it in here?" "Don't know. Maybe. We're ready to roll. Fran, could you hit the lights?" Fran asked. "You ready, Santu?" "No, but let's do it." Complete blackness enveloped them. Larry hit play on the remote. The next section is written in film script format. In a small den computer room, Jerry McMahon sits duct-taped to a chair. Violent, heavy metal music blasts in the background. A handheld home video camera zooms in on him, then zooms out again. Two muscular masked men in black sweats, masks, and gloves work over McMahon. Thug number one has a neck brace and left arm in a sling. He holds a handgun in his right hand. Thug number two is taller and beefier. The edge of a dark birthmark or tattoo rises up the right side of his neck. Thug number one, "Where is she? Where the fuck is she?" McMahon refuses to answer. Thug number two clobbers his face, distorting it and snapping his neck. Thug number one, "Where does she live?" "McMahon, I don't know, I don't know." Thug number two uppercuts McMahon's chin. Blood runs from the corners of his mouth. They continue working him over, breaking face and finger bones, interrogate more, beating more, teeth crack and hang crooked. Thug number one, bullshit, McMahon, sputtering through blood. She moves around. Thug number one, where? McMahon, voice thick, words slurred. All over, they're just dreams, I don't know. Thug number one, dreams, my ass, she broke my arm. You see this some dream, you lying bastard. Thug number two guffaws, while eagle clawing McMahon's thumb. Then he cracks the joint back. McMahon opens his broken mouth to scream, but he gags on blood bubbling out. Thug number one, that feel like a dream, hey dickhead? You tell me something useful, or you'll be feeling a lot more of my loving touch. Where's your rock? McMahon, what rock? For this, McMahon gets a hammer fist to an ear. He throws up. Thug number one, you fucking pig. McMahon, whimpering. She's just a woman with a baby, protecting her baby. Thug number one, so why are you protecting her? McMahon, I'm not. She's nothing. I don't know her. McMahon slumps. Thug number two lifts his head by the hair. McMahon, croaking. By jeez, you're sick. A slightly built man wearing a black sweatsuit, thin black gloves, and black eye mask works on a computer in a corner. He's burning memory stick copies from a DVD with the jewel case beside him. He puts each completed stick into a small metal box. Computer thug, all done, boss, but the plant. To McMahon, why don't you tell them where she is? If you do, they won't kill you. If you're wasted, then I've planted a story on a flash drive. Holds one up. Gonna get found in your kid stuff about you dropping off nuclear waste at sea, a scuzzy racket you and your buddies were in, you understand? You'll look like shit, all of you, and nobody will know the real reason you're pulp. I mean, covering for some whore who beat up my friend. What's the matter with you? Thug number one. So where is she? McMahon moans, shakes his head slightly. His eyes stream tears and blood. Thug number one. Where's the fucking rock? McMahon's voice is a death rattle. He croaks something unintelligible. Thug number one. Oh, for fuck's sake, just finish up. Thug number two swings a hammer broadside at McMahon's mouth. It caves in. McMahon passes out. Thug number one puts a pistol to McMahon's head and blows his brains onto nearby walls. The computer thug takes a memory stick from the computer and puts it in with the others in his small metal box. He plugs in an electric wand that creates a powerful magnetic field which he uses to wipe the hard drive. He ejects the DVD, then uses the hammer to smash the disc to small bits. Thug number one and number two roam the house, searching every shelf and drawer as they go. Thug number one, voiceover, in here! The camera catches up to him in the teenage son's room. They dump a rock collection onto the floor, then paw through it, taking a few pebble-sized ones. The computer thug enters and takes a thumb drive out of his small metal box. Computer thug, tossing the thumb drive onto a pile of clothing, kicking it underneath, laughs. Little red herring for the bloody red fisherman, dumb fuck. The three thugs meet back at the blood-spattered room. Thug number one pumps another shot into McMahon, who bounces for the last time. The video turns to lines and noisy static. Fran jumped for the remote to hit the off button as quickly as she could, then stood rooted to the floor, too stunned to sit down again. Larry and Santu sat paralyzed. Finally, Fran said, "Now what?" They sat longer, working on breathing and blinking. Zombie-like, Santu said, "I need air, sunlight." In the 1950s coffee shop, Fran, Larry, and Santu took the corner booth where they'd last sat. Pat Boone sang Love Letters in the Sand, still yearning after all those years. The three huddled in shock, speaking quietly. Santu said, the rocks they wanted. You think it's like Uncle Sid's?" Fran nodded, "Pretty much." "You sure he's not at risk?" Fran quickly shook her head. "No, I wouldn't worry. The situation's very different now. Plus, your uncle doesn't speak or write, not like Jerry, who made notes." That's what they were copying from the computer. Torturing and killing Jerry was a vengeance crime, the price he paid for the woman injuring a couple of nasty beasts. "Who is she?" Fran said, "Alma's daughter." Santu's eyebrows shot up. Fran continued, "Another set of goons got her last week, abducted her. That's why Alma's talking to your Uncle Sid to see if he can help locate her. His rock gives him, well, it gives him kind of a psychic edge. He's been drawing pictures for her, corroborating other reports. He's safe, don't worry. The whole exercise is a long shot, but it's the best Alma's got right now." Santu said, "Wow, Uncle Sid's always been brave and a bit mystical. This probably doesn't faze him at all. I wouldn't spread it around the family, though. No kidding. He's just visiting with a nice lady, a counselor friend. Santu nodded. He's crazy about her, the liveliest he's been since his stroke. Has he been able to help her? A bit. I know her daughter's with a colleague, some guy who wants to work with her. Is that all? Why the abduction and all the intrigues, not to mention murder, just to work with someone? I don't get it. Fran said, I don't either, not totally. It's really complicated, really arcane. What matters right now is that Pavla's probably okay, nothing newsworthy, that's for sure. Nothing the cops need to know and put her next in line for a snuff video. Santu said, Jesus, Brahma, Buddha, Baal, that's holy, what the hell is going on? And if people are getting wiped for it, how can we just sit on it? The question is, sit on what exactly? I mean, we know the McMahon died to protect this woman, and we can't blow that for all kinds of reasons, most of which we don't know. We can't direct the cops or CIA to Alma because, well, that's just not on, seriously not possible. All the clues the authorities need are in the video. Larry said, so we pass it on with McMahon's files, which refute the Hot Rocks plant. Hello, feds, package for you. We don't know nothing. Santu nod. Suits me fine. I'm too confused right now to help them out of a paper bag. I just want to get rid of this piece of hell. The sooner the better. Fran nodded. The sooner the better for Peggy's Cove, too, to get them off the hook over this illegal dumping BS on top of a murder on top of the fishing boat disaster. God, what a ringer they've been through. I sure bought the scam, only had passing twinge that something was funny about it. Best damn red herring going, and now it's back to square one. Larry said, square zero. Just a fisherman's dream woman, read affair, and some rock rather she gave him, or maybe a diamond ring type rock he gave her, and a jealous pissed off killer who wants it or his woman back. Looks like a nasty domestic to me, or maybe some online hookup turned ugly. Fran shook her head. Poor McMahon. The town's off the hook and he's back to being crazy, and still dead, very dead. At least the killers have bodies and masked faces and voices now. Who cares why the bastards get caught, as long as justice is done? Amen, Larry concluded. All season sports splashed in big blue letters over the yellow awning of Cole Preston's Dartmouth, Nova Scotia Main Street shop. Across the wide front windows, red and white banners shouted, Sale! Inside, multicolor special offer starbursts dotted the walls and racks. He'd filled his 700-square-foot store with summer goods from beach balls to rollerblades, from breezy clothing to a range of footwear. Hockey equipment permanently filled the back corner. Near the front door, Cole stood behind the sales counter. He could see bits of Halifax Harbor through the treed waterfront park across the street. Wind tussled the sea into white caps, shimmering in the high late spring sun. When not serving the occasional customer, he tended to paperwork and inventory. Summer business had been slow, but was picking up. An overweight mother and her gawky teenaged boy walked in. Hi, he said, grinning broadly. Anything special for you? Just browsing, thanks, she replied. The phone rang. All season sports, he said brightly. Cole, Fran said. Fran Roma. She sat in her home office in front of her computer screen, eyes on her screensaver, a slideshow of snapshots from her Athens Christo weekend with Nikos. Cole's face instantly sobered. I'm calling about the video of Jerry McMahon. You know it, right? Cole blanched and twitched. He pressed his lips together, his mouth suddenly dry. He swallowed hard, then croaked. No, he cleared his throat. I wouldn't know about that. Yeah, I thought you'd seen it. Why else would a young reporter run so fast from the story of a lifetime? It's a powerful persuader. Were you sent a copy, or did the killers give you a personal showing? Cole's hands trembled. He couldn't control them or gather his thoughts. Fran waited. After long, painful seconds, he said, The connection's bad. I'm sorry I can't. Fran sighed. I'm sorry, too, that you can't. I assume you watched the whole thing so you know that the Hot Rocks were a scam, a plant. No, I didn't. I don't. Oh, God. Cole struggled to keep his composure. The woman in the shop turned to ask him a question, but stopped when she saw his agitation. She mouthed, Are you okay? He quickly nodded his head and turned away from her. Fran said, Listen, it's clear from the video that the kid's thumb drive was a plant. The Hot Rocks are red herrings. We've got to let the CIA know, same way as before. Media 8 turns it over. We don't know who sent it. Then they figure out that the kid's story is a ruse to keep them from getting to the real story and the killers. Cole, this is good news. He pulled himself together as best he could. Well, thank you for calling. I'm sorry that I don't carry things like that in the store. Nothing. His voice trailed off. Wait, there's more. The goons that got the woman, the one Jerry was protecting? She's alive and probably okay. They got what they want, you hear? You're not in danger as long as she's cooperating, and she is, believe me. You can stop trembling in your boots. Boots? Yeah, sure, I got hiking boots, wetsuit. Cole, for God's sake, I'm trying to tell you not to worry should the CIA or cops come back to you for more information. You don't have to play completely dumb anymore, okay? If they press you about the rock, you can tell them Jerry picked it up when he survived the shipwreck. A good luck charm from the beach, something like that, just an ordinary rock. The killers were way, way off base. I don't know that, I'm sorry. No, I guess you don't, and I can't convince you this way. We need to talk, really talk. Let's set a time, and I'll tell you things about Jerry and his ramblings that'll put your mind to rest. No, I can't, I'm not in that business. Okay, okay, I give up. When they get the killers, I'll let you know. If. Either way, you can stop sweating it. You're out of the loop. Yeah, I've made sure of it, he swallowed, his mouth still dry. As sure as I can. I guess you have. Good luck, Cole. Sorry, ma'am, he hung up. Fran walked downstairs to the kitchen to find Nikos and Luna sharing her teething biscuits. Luna's cheeks had rosy patches the size of quarters and drool wetting her bib. Lord Byron looked up hopefully from Nikos's feet, waiting for a bit of cookie to fall, or a crumb at least. He's seen it, Fran said. He's still in total denial. Maybe he'll get over it. Maybe after the killers are caught, if they're caught, as he just said. The CIA probably likes the nuclear waste idea, but that rabbit hole will get them instigating a massive bogus WND fiasco with an ocean search as vast as Flight 370. It has macho appeal, but if they do their groundwork at Peggy's Cove right, they'll quickly get that it's a red herring and stop that fishing expedition. As for the real story, they'll never connect the dots, as far as I can see, and that ain't very far with all this weird stuff. I can't figure either why some cabal of fundamentalists want to waste these women. And this bright little spark, what's she done? Fran took Luna in her arms and gave her a kiss on each red cheek. Ooh, a tasty peach, she said, evoking a twinkly grin. You are so wonderful, full of wonders, and I am so lost. What do you know that I don't know? And Nikos, she asked slowly, what, in the name of all that's holy, are we doing? The right thing, he said, putting his arm around Fran's shoulders. He held up his big, time-worn hand to Luna, who wrapped her tiny, plump grip around his thumb. Under the hot morning sun, Fran lifted a heavy cardboard box from her car and packed it into May's house. She put the box down on the front porch, then made several increasingly sweaty trips, carrying more boxes containing her computer, monitor, scanner, printer, paper, and other office essentials. She cleared the dining table by stacking files atop the existing paper towers. Later, she had everything wired and working in their new home. She scanned a sheet of May's bold schoolteacher's hand, then ran it through the free OCR for handwriting program she downloaded, but the text output wasn't acceptable, too many letters misidentified. She photoshopped the image of May's handwriting to increase sharpness and contrast and ran the program again. Better, but not much. She rescanned at higher resolution and tried a third time. She web-searched more, which got her into ICR for intelligent character recognition, then CNN for convolutional neural networks tasks, way too intelligent and convoluted for her immediate need. She downloaded a free trial program, apparently the best out there for her task, but it still produced too many typos. She relented and bought the professional upgrade, which worked close to perfectly, but there were still a few logical errors that spell and grammar check wouldn't catch. Proofreading OCR transcriptions of May's vast files to check for glitches page by page was out of the question. How accurate did they have to be? Would good enough be good enough? By noon, Fran felt beaten, but like a dog with a bone, wouldn't let it go. It's got to work, damn it. Customize. She again read the instructions for customizing characters. I need to create an average, a new May average. She leaned back in her chair and exclaimed to the ceiling, oh, I can't do it. I can't do SFA with this OCR, ICR, CNN, AIIT, OMG, WTFing, alphabet, geek soup, help. The front door knocker thunked. Damn, she muttered as she went to answer. I don't want any, and if you can't help, go away. She opened the door to an arthritic, frizzy, gray-haired old lady in a silky floral dress. She rested one hand on a wooden cane and clutched a manila envelope in the other. "Yes," Fran said with delight, ushering her in quickly. Inside and safe, Alma stood up straight and took off her wig. She shook out her heat-matted hair, saying, "I've come from seeing Luna. Nico said you were here." "Yay, one thrilled baby, hey?" "Yes, and one thrilled grandma. I'm going to visit her now and then when I'm in town and en route to or from D.C. Will you stay with us, or maybe here?" "I'm tempted, but no, I've got other accommodations close to my work in Washington. When things have settled more, I will, if you'll take me at a moment's notice." "Of course." "Now, what am I interrupting?" "Nothing except keeping me from pulling out my hair. It's break time. Would you like some sun tea?" Alma nodded. Fran led Alma through the dining room, past her sleeping computer, to the kitchen to get a big, full pitcher from the old fridge. "I'm trying to scan May's notes and convert them to text. It'll be a lot easier to read them that way, and then we'll have copies to store in various ways, all with your approval, of course. It's not working quite well enough yet, and I've tried everything. Now I'm wondering how important accuracy is." "It is, but I wouldn't worry about it. For now, putting everything away in categories would be a good start." "Yeah, that's step one of plan A, but how I do it might determine step two or ten or plan B after I've found the floor here again. I thought that a test run converting handwriting to text would help me figure out what to do next and next. If you're okay with some mistakes in text versions of May's notes." Alma nodded. "Totally fine. If you need a discreet assistant or two, I can help you. Just say. I can get them here quickly." "Wow, great offer. But no, I'm good on my own right now. I need to familiarize myself with all this and, while I'm doing it, try to think. Help would distract me. Down the road, though, that would be great." They adjourned to the living room, frosty tea glasses in hand, and wilted into the furniture. Alma still had the manila envelope, which she held up. "I've got more work for you. Good news, too, I guess, as good as it gets." She took a dozen printed pages from the envelope and put them on a stack of May's files. Rochelle Dupont's report. Fantastic. What she found? Rochelle connected with Trigliani and promptly got into his research team with two others, Dr. Luigi Borelli and Dr. Henry Krebs. Borelli is key to this report, bless him, and Rochelle, too. She's brilliant. Luckily, Pavla has shared just enough of her findings with Rochelle to let her squeak in. She'll have very filtered contact with Pavla, strictly about their research. My daughter is apparently alive and well in a beautiful place, but unreachable, unrescuable. Alma sighed heavily, and no end in sight to her disappearance. Any idea where? Alma shook her head. Only Trigliani knows, and Michelle doesn't think he'll tell anyone. I suspect that he might not even have told his superiors to keep them and their henchmen away from her, and perhaps to keep his bosses from killing him, too, as long as they have to go through him to get to her. It's a dicey game. Jerry had more than one killer, more than one person willing to murder to get to her. Since she injured a second man, much more seriously than a broken arm, she's in great danger if they ever locate her. Where do you think Trigliani would hide her? Where dreams are blocked, that's all I know. In a lead-lined structure, Faraday cage, maybe a cave? I won't continue to actively search for her for fear that I might inadvertently lead assassins to her. Rochelle will stay tuned to Trigliani and keep us posted, but finding out where my girl is could be far more dangerous than not knowing. Fran said, tough job, mind racing, doing nothing. I had a little taste of it with Leanne lately, and it nearly killed me. Alma nodded with a sad, appreciative smile. He might drop a clue now and then. Michelle can push him a bit, but if she goes a little too far, there's a little misunderstanding and snap, she's first in the line of fire. She's one brave lady. Very clever, thank goodness. We have such dedicated supporters, so many working behind the scenes at great risk to themselves and everyone, you included. Not to alarm you, but I have to be truthful. Technology helps us in ways, but advances in surveillance and tracking may defeat us. I hope that Trigliani's smart about outwitting every possibility and that our allies stay under the Big Brother radar, so to speak. Do you think Pavla knows Michelle's on board? Oh, I'm sure. It'll help her be contented and focus on being productive, I hope, while biding her time and working out possibilities of escape. Trigliani will have her working, that's certain. Michelle confirmed what Angela said, that he is enamored of Pavla, which may be her trump card if she plays it right. We'll see. How did Michelle get this report to you? You can't be seen with her, can you? No, it came through hard copy channels using ordinary post, which is surprisingly efficient and anonymous. It's the only copy, very old-fashioned and trusting. It's too risky to communicate online or on phone networks, or to leave any materials with her. You'll find a dresser drawer of files about Pavla in Mother's old room here. There's one drawer each for Mother, me, Pavla, and Luna. Alma handed Fran the envelope. Could you add this to Pavla's records? Gladly. May I read it, and read about you and Luna as well? Of course. It's all yours. Should I start there? I really don't know what to do with any of this, where to look, how to make sense of it. I'm just a trained puppy, you know, a newshound. Until I get the scent, I don't have a clue what I'm after. Wanting to figure this out isn't anything like knowing how to go about it. And please don't say peripherals. I'm so deep in peripherals here, I'm lost. Alma laughed. I suggest that you start by reading all the material in Mother's drawer. She wanted her story told in book form, a concise biography written. Fran's eyes widened. Oh, no, not me. Alma smiled, shaking her head. It would best be someone who met her, even briefly, to have sensed her immense presence, vitality, charisma. Since we dare not remove her files from this house, perhaps you could digitize all of them onto a hard drive for safe transfer to a biographer. That would help immensely. And it's of the most immediate importance in terms of all of this. She waved her hands wide over May's vast collection. That I can do, exactly the scent I need to get going. I hope it helps me start to make sense of everything else. It will, because it's all quite simple, really. Think of these, every file in this house, as beads on a string. The string is a unifying theory, no, more like a unifying reality. Get to know some of the beads, and they'll all fall into line. Actually, I've got a little task to do here that might help. Mother made films in the early 1940s, and they're stored in the basement. May and I watched one recently, and it appears to be well preserved, but I'd like to get them stabilized, then digitized. If you wouldn't mind someone doing that work in here, sometime in the next year or so. No, that would be fine. Maybe I could view the films then. Alma nodded. That would be good. They help clarify, in a distilled way. You know, I think they're intact enough that we could watch one now, if you'd like. It might be worth 1,000 words of explanation. I'd love to. No blood and guts, though. I'm not up to it. Even play-acted. Oh, dear Fran, that was an awful thing to do to you. I'm sorry, but you have to know what some people will do to get to us and what hatred drives them, far more than a few broken bones merit. It's crazy and horrifying. I don't understand it all. So let's get on with filling you in. She finished her tea. I think you'll like Mother's old films. They're about new life and love, I promise.
As Alma set up the projector, as May had done, she said, My grandmother, Sunokwa, experimented in creating affordable color film, including this one made in 1942. She'd hoped that it would have some spin-off benefits to help end the war. Really? Not long after Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz. Yes, she helped tweak the Technicolor system, working with Professor Herbert Kalmus, who had invented it. She experimented with her improvements in the production of her films, all made behind the scenes and put immediately into storage. This is the only copy. What a terrible risk, should anything happen to it. Would you mind if I video it with my phone as we watch it? Poor quality, but something. Good idea, but we'll use my mobile. It's untraceable, then we can download it onto a computer that must, you understand, never be connected to the Internet. I'll have a new machine sent to you, arriving tomorrow. Ooh, Fran said, I converted a page of May's writing to text using online programs. That's okay, one page isn't a problem, or likely 2 or 10, but best to err on the side of caution. Fran asked, and your mobile, does it dump everything, like daily? More often, and I change SIM cards and burners all the time. They're such a mixed blessing. There, Sunokwa's film is ready to roll. Would you mind drawing the curtains? As Fran pulled the heavy, dusty draperies tightly shut, she asked, Where is the name Sunokwa from? Land of rare golden spruces, Alma said. Ah, Fran replied. I've read the book. Wasn't there only one in Haida Gwaii? That's part of the myth. There are a few others, and now many more are cloned. Sunokwa, however you spell it, is a forest spirit, best known for bringing wealth and frightening children. But a painter of her image, named Emily Carr. I did a piece on her, Fran said. I have a book of her paintings, powerful stuff. To Carr, Alma said, Sunokwa appeared to be a singing spirit, young and fresh, passing through the jungle. No violence coarsened her, no power domineered to wither her. She was graciously feminine. That version of her best matches my grandmother, the Sinoqua you will get to know from May's notes. In her notes, you'll also find the scripts for these films, but nothing like seeing this work, which the world will be ready for one day, or is why Maya's story must be published, and soon. This is part of it, a pearl on the string. Alma flipped the toggle switch for the projector's motor and advanced the film to the opening bullseye. In May's hot, dark living room, the title Mary flickered on the silver screen, an original symphonic score composed by May's first husband, David, came sweetly to life again, and young Maya's ghost rose in a dance of light and colors. This is film script format. Mary is very pregnant, wrapped in loose robes and shawl over her hair. She's played by Sinoqua in her 20s. Mary's mother, Anne, wearing similar clothing, stands near her. She's played by Sinoqua's mother. Joseph, bearded and robed, helps Mary sit side saddle on a donkey outside a peasant's adobe home. He's played by David. He exits, leaving the two women alone. Anne, they're brutes, these census takers, forcing this journey for their convenience. Mary, please, mother, it's torment to keep hoping and wishing that you might come to help with the birth. I'll be fine. You've instructed Joseph well. He'll keep me safe and everything clean. Anne sighs. I hope so. The risk will be worth it if you make it to the Bethlehem Caves, the most propitious place for our birth. Still, I'll worry until I see the three of you safely back here. Joseph enters and overhears her last words. Joseph, hand on Anne's shoulder. Mother Anne, I can't tell you not to worry, but I will protect them with my life and every shred of my wits. Anne hugs Joseph. He leads Mary away on the donkey. Anne walks a short distance with them, holding Mary's hand, then lets go and waves goodbye. Cut to Joseph and Mary meeting a shepherd on rolling hills. The sun is setting, burnishing Mary to ethereal beauty. Shepherd, my God, an angel! Joseph laughs. No, just a man and his wife and child-to-be. We've come for the census and require shelter. Shepherd, ha, you've come too late. There's nothing available unless you're filthy rich. Joseph, we understand there are caverns. Shepherd, where we keep our sheep dry and warm, and even they are crowded, so many people arriving for the census. Joseph, have you one that we might overnight in? Shepherd, yes, but madness for such a pregnant woman, but suit yourself, pointing east. It's crude and dirty. Should she give birth there? She'll add that mess to the mud and dung. Joseph, we'll give you no grief, I swear to you, as God is the Father, and the birth, wherever it takes place, will be clean and the donkey brays. Joseph, continuing after the braying, voice hushed, immaculate. Cut 2. Joseph and Mary creeping by lantern light into the opening to a cave at the edge of Bethlehem Village, a hub of scattered homes and shops. The cave is a basement, more or less, under a crude stone shelter. Inside, they share it with sheep, cows, and other livestock that drink from stone troughs. In a nook, Joseph and Mary make a bed, laying blankets over straw. Cut 2. Clouds over the shepherd's field, shifting to reveal a startlingly bright star rising on the eastern horizon. The shepherd looks in awe. Shepherd mutters to himself, God is the Father. The birth, immaculate, eyes widen, starts running. The Christ, David returns, it must be. Cut 2. Mary's face contorting in labor. The contractions are intense. Joseph enters the cave, carrying a pitcher of water, and sits beside her. Her face relaxes as the contraction abates. Joseph, Mary, I'm worried. The woman who sold me this water for the price of wine is shaking from the news, from the rumor that the Christ has come to be born here. A shepherd from the field of Ruth said that he saw an angel bringing the prayed-for Savior from the Romans. David returned to slay the new Goliath. From descriptions, I think he's the shepherd who directed us here, and now he's run off to tell the world and distant kings. Worse, Mary, an amazingly bright star has risen in the sky, a powerful portent. Mary groans. Oh, no. Luckily, the hills are riddled with caves. It will be difficult for anyone to locate us in this one. Does the woman know why you wanted water? Did anyone see you return here? Joseph shakes his head. No, we are one of many couples in need of food and water. I saw other pregnant women. Mary, wincing as a contraction grips her. It's too late to go anywhere else, and it's safer in here than out there. Joseph, if they find us here and discover the truth, is that so bad? Maybe it's time for the truth to be known. Mary pants, fighting for breath, sweating anew. As the contraction eases, she's able to speak. Mary, touching his cheek. You are so sweet. No wonder I love you so, Joseph, dear Joseph. The truth will shock and anger them, for they expect the Christ to be a boy, and my God-given child can only be a girl. What they cannot accept, they will destroy. Joseph, then I will give them their boy if and when they find us. Squalling announces the birth of Mary's baby, which is clearly a girl. Joseph washes the babe with a clean rag, swaddles her in white linen, and lays her by his exhausted wife's side. He leaves Mary to sleep. Joseph returns to the cave carrying a baby boy, similarly wrapped. He approaches Mary, bending on his knee to whisper in her ear. Mary's eyes flicker open. She rouses herself. Her face shows renewed worry about their predicament. Joseph, I have a boy child, an orphan. His mother has died. His father is long missing. His siblings cannot keep him. He needs to nurse, and he needs a home. We need a boy. It's so simple. He's healthy enough and only a few months old. Mary, a few months? They'll be looking for a newborn. Joseph, they are looking for the Christ, searching every cave. Let the shepherd find us and identify us now. Look at this little fellow. He's small and hungry, but beautiful. He will satisfy them. From one of the stone troughs, Joseph made a bed for the baby boy. Mary then kneels to tend him in it. Joseph stands close by. The baby girl sleeps to the side in the blankets on straw. Three kings in opulent robes and jewels fall to their knees in awe, offering their gifts to the infant in the manger. First king, my lord, the Christ reborn. Mary's baby starts fussing. Clearly newborn cries. Mary turns and looks anxiously at her. Joseph puts his arm around her shoulders. First king, another infant? Joseph, quickly, a baby girl we're minding while her mother is elsewhere. His voice trails off. Mary smiles. The kings ignore the cries of a mere girl and return their attention to the divine boy. Second king, what is our Lord's name? Mary, Jesus Emmanuel. Third king, ah, our Lord has come, as Isaiah said, heir of David, we are delivered. Mary, smiling at Joseph, yes, we are saved. As Alma reopens the drapes, Fran sat motionless, unable to catch her spinning thoughts enough to form even a simple sentence. Alma said, I was in Nepal when Pavla was abducted, preparing to make a sequel to Mother's film about Buddha's purported mother, Mahamaya. We were going to make a sequel to this one, close to Bethlehem, later this year, than others elsewhere. Without Pavla, however, Alma's voice faded as tears welled up. Fran whispered, what will you do? Alma gathered herself. No more reenactments, that's certain. I don't have the energy to do any theatrical work now, even as a consultant for plays such as Raoul's or the other storytelling work I do. I'll get back to it, I'm sure, but not now. I'll just keep up some of my usual rounds and stay tuned to how I might help Pavla, of course. What are your usual rounds? I travel the world seeing all kinds of people, acting as an advisor, counselor, and encourager, really. I'm often in Washington for obvious reasons, influencing where I can. Very few know my true identity. To most, I'm a lobbyist, consultant, whatever position and title works. It's the family business, more or less. What do you counsel? Whatever people need to hear and get doing to realize the potential and make a better world. Larry, for example, needed the courage to shake up his life and get on with making his dreams come true. Either that or risk losing his health to a killing job. He's done his homework over the years and with the right nudge has shown that he was ready to begin his real life's work. More than a nudge, France said. Your idea is brilliant. Alma smiled. Thank you. I hope it proves positive. We have to change how we view and tell the news for the collective good on this overburdened planet. Larry, bless him, seems to be the perfect choice, mother's advice, for forwarding my idea. Another case in point is Siddhartan. We share a passion for yoga as a body-mind-spirit practice, and he's interested in developing a program for others in wheelchairs. I help him create it and get it published. He's a genius, with more to share now in ways than when he was on his feet. Fran laughed lightly. He can dream you doing yoga. What a handy shortcut. And a handy inspiration for me,
keeping me doing it
at times like this when discouragement could immobilize me. I can't dream him, though, so I'll come to visit him as often as I can. He has so much to teach me and the world. I suppose you'll stay in touch with Angela, too, in case Pavla returns to her dreams. Alma nodded. Yes, I'm going to meet her soon, and I so look forward to it, quite separate from our dream connection. She's immensely capable, a truth-seer and truth-sayer of the first order. I've assured her aunt that she'll suffer no ill effects from Serena's disastrous counseling, because Angela's so certain of herself from the deepest inner core. To back up that strength, I've suggested that they rely on her school counselor for practical advice. She's a spunky and astute woman, just what Angela needs. You contacted this counselor? Yes, by phone, with Mrs. Cho's permission. We shared some thoughts, and I made a suggestion or two. We agreed that Angela is bound to succeed, with or without professional help, through her losses, as long as she has good health and a supportive home base, which she does, in spades. How she'll express her strengths, who knows? It won't matter. Even in a most private role, even as just, in quotes, a mum and homemaker, she's sure to make an important difference. Good parenting always has enormously positive ripple effects. Fran laughed. She certainly rearranged my life from the minute I found her, turning me into just a mum and homemaker as best I can possibly be. Who else is on your rounds? We know all sorts of prominent people, leaders in many fields. We're always at various stages of meeting and courting them, gaining their confidence. But you see, I'm still thinking as we, Mother, Pavla, and me. I can't cover half the ground we used to because I'm alone now. Because much of our work is taxing and risky, I'm too distracted to be as aware and cautious as I should be, so I'll only see established connections and selected new ones for the time being. It seems so unfair, Fran said. You work tirelessly, so that everyone you know, me included, ends up better off for knowing you, yet here you are, with life being unbelievably cruel to you and Pavla. Alma closed her eyes briefly. So it seems, but two thoughts come to mind. First, we're also better off for each person we come to trust. It's entirely a two-way street. Most who dream or listen to us go on to greater success, which is why it weighs terribly on me that Jerry McMahon suffered so unspeakably, the worst in recent times by far. I grieve yet more that his suffering was used to intimidate others, and that it may be used in that way for years to come. What a horrid thought, Fran said. Of course they'll use it to shut up anyone who's seen Pavla lately or knows where she is. What beasts! And that's my second thought, that our enemies don't know us, and until they do, there's no hope of either camp being better off. They've rejected the very idea of our existence. But why? What have you done? Mary's story is particularly illustrative. It's one of hundreds on a long line of beads, as I said, strung on the thread of parthenogenesis, which you've probably deduced by now. We go back to the beginning of recorded history, to Inanna, Ninkursag, Nintu, Lilith, Eve, just a few names from the lineage you may know best. Every culture and continent has its equivalents, and they're all connected. Over time, names and life stories jumbled and morphed. That's what May's sorting out, to make a definitive lineage of these begats, a line that continues to this day, to Luna. Begats begun how? A divine spark, but we make no attribution, for it would be just a name. We're fully human, without knowledge of our pre-births. And we're of special creation, too, with unique gifts and particular work to do. Since the beginning of written language, for many hundreds of generations, we have been active and, to varying degrees, successful. When we cannot do our work, dark ages ensue. We're a long, thin line, and we continue. Pavla is the first to figure out the science of our reproduction and trigger her replication using in vitro techniques. I thought this ability would strengthen our line by removing that difficult, uncertain process. How, in particular? First, by removing the sort of trauma required to force parthenogenesis. It can be brutal, nothing any mother wants for her girl. What sort of trauma? It involves great love and great loss, an emotional, psychic, and physical reaction to the point of near death. Such as? Alma shook her head, smiling. Perhaps too soon to tell you such details now. The second reason for cheering Pavla's in vitro success is the possibility of our having a second daughter should the first be killed. It's getting ever harder to hide and flee in this world of spying devices and cyber connectivity. Why not have two living daughters, three? No, we must accept the wisdom of our history. There's always only been one per generation. It's obviously part of nature to limit our numbers. Luckily, our newborns are immensely healthy, and each of us has made it to date, haven't we, from the mists of time to Luna. There are rumored tales of the youngest of the line dying and a second being engendered from that horror, so deep was the mother's grief, but May's research hasn't traced any evidence. The process is not easily endured twice. Pavla's work may uncover and overcome the reasons why, but that won't make it practicable or desirable unless it's absolutely necessary. Even if we dared to have 10 children, one is best logistically, since we travel endlessly for our work as well as to avoid danger. Imagine trying to pack up, dodge, and run with two or more children together, or worse, apart. It's a constant war zone out there for us. Fran sighed. Unthinkable. I don't know how you do it. Alma smiled. We're blessed with great health and self-healing, but we do get tired. Pavla's achievement has eased one aspect of our lives, yet her success has exposed us to the priesthood of high science, which now controls our fate to a large extent. Science, at least, wants Pavla alive to exploit our physiology. The traditional priesthood requires our removal entirely. Eyes wide, Fran said, Everything you say generates 1,000 more questions until I could burst. I don't know which to ask first. She took a breath. The story goes back to, in the beginning was the word, doesn't it? Why then? Perfect insight. Humankind arose when vocalizations necessary for survival became words. The recording of these words in clay tablets and on other materials were first for keeping accounts, nothing more than counting and tallies. My roots, it seems, trace back to the great leap of written records being used to record histories, beliefs, future plans, laying out sequences of what's where, who's who, what matters, and so much more. Did the first of us introduce this language tool? Perhaps, but there's no point to solving that riddle. What matters is that we are, as we have always been, a force dedicated to seeing that our words are used to educate and save us from our basest nature. It's a double-edged sword because every mother tongue also serves aggressive gains at the cost of other lives and the earth itself. Fortunately, the benefits outweigh the dangers, and humanity has flourished, in recent times, too well. As ever, language and education must be employed in new ways to save us from our rapidly reproducing, over-consuming selves. Advising and enlightening our elite, whose power is global and growing, has never been so important. I do that, as I've told you, and I use the power of storytelling, too, on the stage, as you've seen, to press some issues. This is my primary passion, while Pavla's is scientific research. Mother had applied sciences and Zen arts interest, becoming a self-defense master and teaching us. We all must be physically adept in that way, but she was supreme. She expressed herself in many disciplines over her life, all rooted in the strength of dhyana, practice of Zen in motion. Dhyana, as in my daughter Dhyana? That's her full name. Yes, meaning meditation, as I'm sure you know, the penultimate step to enlightenment. Why didn't she aim for the top? Alma smiled. That would be a conceit, ensuring that it's never attained. The view from the penultimate is of the ultimate, and the vision suffices, because the clarity of the vision and its clear communication, so others understand the path and purpose, have far greater collective benefits than any individual attainment. Fran laughed. I invited that, didn't I? Stupid question to ask a walking fount of hundreds of generations of wisdom. I have never felt so small. We're all actually founts of hundreds of generations of wisdom because we live and breathe. Our kind and our line, whatever it is for each living thing, has made it this far. As for my line, we're no different from you in most ways. We're fully flesh and blood, and we learn as you see Luna learning from the ground up. We have some gifts, to be sure, an intricate, dense language area in our brains, as I've told you, and other physical gifts, one of which is an enhanced immune system, which Rochelle's report touches on, the topic of interest to Pavla's captors that's keeping her alive. Fran looked puzzled. What do you mean, an enhanced immune system? Alma smiled. We're very resistant to diseases of every sort, toxins, other bodily assaults, and we heal quickly. Ah, lots of Neanderthal. No, a different genetic mechanism, but similar outcome, only much more complete. So you should be able to live for hundreds of years. No, that's in the telomeres, which you and I and all of us share, nature's snipping tool, to make way for new life. While I'd love for Mother to have lived forever, she was spent, her every cell ready to release its vital energy. The particulars of that apparently tie in with how our immune systems work, or so Pavla tells me. Rochelle's report will fill you in a bit, and I believe Pavla sent May a private paper or two about her understanding of it, which should be in her drawer here. So Pavla's work is saving her. It's the card she's playing with Trigliani, but don't ask me for details. I don't speak her research language. No need for both of us to be fluent, for a number of reasons. Pavla's and May's studies boggle me as thoroughly as they do you. I needn't burden myself with remembering even a fraction of it, unless that were my bent, which it isn't, because the operative truth remains simple. Through our calling and accumulated wisdom, we've had the ear and hearts of many great leaders who have led the world and tried to teach the best ways of living respectfully together, within nature's means. Moses, Buddha, Confucius, Jesus, Muhammad, these are a few whose works have stood the tests of time and continue to dominate. Every continent and era has its charismatic wise men who have listened, taught well, and risen to the heights of inspired leadership. And you and your ancestors have been with them all along, everywhere and with every prophet, guru, and holy man who made a difference. If we weren't there, unfortunately, they came to naught. Even when we were, measurable success was rare, although spectacular when achieved. Fran dared say, it sounds fantastical. Counter to everything I've ever learned about the march of history at a fundamental level, at a causal level. You're saying that all the great men, all their great words and deeds were inspired by the female muses, the seven muses, the many hundred everywhere, throughout recorded time. Back to in the beginning was the word? Alma nodded. But why? Why always underground? You've seen what danger we're in when we surface, when we can be located even for 5 minutes. We have to work with the nature of the animal. Humanity insists, with rare exceptions, on following dominant males, and we have had little influence changing that. We must operate through the established order of things, at least until society is ready for other patterns. At no time through recorded history has the world been ready to accept that divine women or divinely inspired women can be independently revered leaders. Although the great revolution of our time, where women have risen beyond their animal functions and the work of serving daily needs, gives me hope that, in this new millennium, my descendants will be able to live and work freely and openly, and advise independent women to the topmost positions. But why would anyone want to kill you? So what if you engendered Buddha's wisdom, for example? He's no less wise for having learned it through you. He didn't mind crediting the paupers and wise men he met in his travels, although I guess it would rock the foundations of a few hundred million followers to give a woman her due. Those who can't accept us feel compelled to destroy us. We've managed to work with the preferred male hierarchy, preferred by many women too, from our beginnings, in every culture that insists on it. Only a few don't. Much of our work is to advise men to be thoughtful and wise, as you heard me say, playing Gaia on the Athens stage, but we're seen as usurpers, as ones whose very existence undoes the legitimacy of every bastion of male-dominated power, particularly of the major world religions. So, Mary gives birth to a parthenogenetic daughter who would be rejected and killed had Joseph not substituted the orphan boy whom they raised as the great second coming of the Christ, who heeded Mary's wisdom. Mary tried and mostly succeeded. He grew to be a truly great man, but he failed in his choice of supporters. Judas did him in, and Paul carried on, traveling extensively to spread his ministry, tainting it with deep misogyny. They had their own agendas and notions of what God intended. Jesus, alas, failed to fully follow the advice he was given, and it cost him his life. Advice by his mother, his sister? Alma nodded. And grandmother Anne? Who did they listen to? Who do you? I mean, do you hear God? Alma smiled. A certain wisdom seems innate, an inner voice that guides with irresistible force and power. It's deeper than hearing or any of the senses. It's a profound knowing with this earthly body as its conduit. It's sufficient work and pleasure to keep the instrument tuned in every way so that we might resonate fully with our gifts. We're all conduits, really. The trick is to honor the body-mind-spirit temple, build strong advisory connections, and guide them in their understandings and action. Still, our best efforts spin out of control without constant correction. Mohammed, husband of Khadija, one of our line, is a good example. He listened to her, but his understanding was imperfect and his transcription worse still. Hence, his teachings among countless millions are now horribly skewed by unenlightened clerics. Mother risked her life trying to right some of this vast misinterpretation and misrule. Her final protest, you mean? Just one of so many throughout her life. Every action was small, daring, and filled with the hope and the rare but proven certainty that sometimes a pebble nudge just the right way, at just the right time, sets off a landslide of change. Alma stood up to stretch her legs. We've covered a lot of ground. Let it filter and settle in. You've got the core truth of it now. All the rest is details. Fran sat immobile, her eyes surveying May's massive piles of work. Slowly she rose and, in awe, read aloud the names on the spines of files within view. Anath, Sibella, Zikam, Diktiana, Chokma, Fohi, Tiamat, Isis, Pesinuatika, Naith, Persephone, Mater Matuta, Pele, Miriam, Gaia, Leda, Sophia, Varimati Takara, Kalileach, Khatija, Telea. And these are just a few of the thousands of names that make up hundreds of generations. Alma nodded her head. Every continent, every society, we're on the move continually and have lived everywhere. We are maiden, mother, and crone. We're all noted here, as many as May could gather, working diligently for long years. Some of us have achieved splendidly. Many could do no more than survive, but that's an achievement too. We live, we breathe, we work as best we can. Agape, Fran said, Luna, my God, she scares the wits out of me. The latest of the line. It could be snapped like that. Luna should be raised in a fortress on an island in a place where she's guaranteed to be safe. Alma laughed. No, experience makes clear the folly of that. Safety is in living the most ordinary lives possible, just another among millions. She's a normal, everyday baby in nearly every way, and the more normal and everyday her upbringing, the better she'll be equipped to apply her talents and stay close to the pulse. You live next door to D.C., the world's greatest power center, and like it or not, she needs to know well this region and its operation, because she'll work a lot from here when she's ready. In such familiarity, there's safety, security, and comfort. She has Nikos now, who showed me his colors when we traveled in Greece. For her, as for all children, good men in her life are vital and irreplaceable. And you, Alma smiled, you have many positive traits by which Luna will thrive. Your ability to assess situations, make decisions quickly, then get into them or out of them without hesitating is a key to her safety. I know through your work and from talking to Larry that your instincts in this way are spot on, and when you're committed to something, you stay clear and sharp with no doubts. You're worldly, you found your way in many diverse societies, and with admirable determination and grace have gotten to the essentials needed for in-depth quality reports. You've survived and thrive in arduous working conditions, undaunted by challenge. You're globally very aware and nicely rooted here now. I'm well aware that you weren't a full-time mother, but you're ready to take on that role now, with gusto, I'm sure. The Anne is very much your girl, a strong, bright spirit. She'll make a fine big sister. And you can teach Luna from May's work, as you learn yourself. In total, this life can't match Pavla raising her daughter, but it's as safe as can be and full of good, dedicated, informed hearts. Flushed with this assessment, Fran said, quite a report card. I'm humbled and still reeling. I mean, you've got all kinds of other contacts. Why not someone you know better? I've considered this thoroughly. I trust you, Fran, you and Nikos. On my list of worries, well, you two looking after Luna aren't on it. Fighting to contain her emotions, Fran said, I'm glad and I'm Alma, I'm honored and overwhelmed and daunted. Don't be. One breath, 1 minute, one day at a time. Now, should we call it a day regarding all this? Is that all this is, a day? Alma nodded. And tomorrow's another. Let's deal with it then. After Alma left May's house, Fran sat dazed on the sofa in a nest of paper stacks. She stared at Rochelle's report, unable to focus her thoughts sufficiently to reach for it. Uncounted minutes later, she forced herself to plunge into Rochelle's account of life at the sticky center of Trigliani's web. This is Rochelle Dupont's account of her trip with Trigliani to his lab in the country. Dear Alma, I was going to be coy and use encoded names throughout this, but so much else is telling. Why bother? This is a straight-up report of what I know and have gathered so far. First are notes of my chat with Trigliani at his country fortress lab. I thought of recording it, but too risky if caught. I'm sure he was taping for his nasty bosses. We had a tight meeting, not very productive. Krebs remained suspicious of me. No, professionally cautious is more accurate. But Borelli was surprisingly forthcoming after Krebs left. He's glad I'm a member of the team working from my lab, and he's as grateful as I am that Trigliani has some caring for Pavla. He was alarmed enough after his first meetings with her that he scribbled some notes. He gave me copies, and I've worked them up into Section 2 of this report. Section 3 is a postscript for what it's worth. Regards, Rochelle. Section 1 isn't included here because it's Rochelle's notes on her trip with Trigliani to the country mansion and lab. Section 2. Borelli and Krebs first saw Pavla in the dining room of the country mansion just after 7 p.m. on the evening of the abduction. They had no idea then that she was there against her will. They were seated already, waiting for Trigliani to arrive. Big deluxe room. Gourmet meal in the offing. Krebs at the foot of the table, Borelli to one side. Trigliani escorted Pavla into the dining room. Borelli said that they looked like a couple arriving at a French restaurant. She in a black sheath, pearls, hairs up. Tea all dapper as usual. He seated her across from Borelli, then took the head of the table. Trigliani introduced Pavla by saying that he had first thought her name was the usual Pavla Paola for Paul, meaning little, with Saul, Paul, biblical Roman Catholic connections, but it's not that. He gave the real story as follows, apparently with some appreciation for it. Pavla Blanca's name was bequeathed for her birthplace at White Sands in New Mexico. An Apache creation myth tells us that the giver of life warned the Apache people of a great deluge, directing white painted woman to safety in an abalone shell. She survived the flood and the shell beached at White Sands. She gave birth to two children, son of the sun and child of the water. Alma's notes in the margin. Sons often added substitute, reference Buddha, Jesus et al. This woman was the Apache's greatest figure of power. They also called her Changing Woman. She knew how to rid the world of evil, and she never aged, but was endlessly recreated just as the sands are endlessly renewed. Spaniard Hernando de Luna marched to White Sands with Conquistador Coronado in the mid-1500s. He brought his fiancée, Manuela. Apache warriors killed the entire party. Manuela's ghost can still be seen at sunset, her white wedding gown blowing like sand in the wind. She is known as Pavla Blanca. To see her once is good luck, twice is bad luck, three times brings death. T asked, is this not the source of your name? Pavla replied, death to whom? By whose count? She didn't need any introduction to Borelli and Krebs. Said she knew their publications and had seen their photos in magazine articles. T doesn't put his mugshot anywhere. The new cult of science stardom, she said. Not too wise when you're up to no good. T was worried that she'd be resistant and blow everything, although putting fear into B and K would be good. Trigliani started the meal with a prayer. He said everything in proper order. He thanked the Almighty Father for this fateful day and meal, then something about being honored by this opportunity to keep the sanctity of God's Trinity, the inviolate perfection of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, pure and forevermore, and thanks for the food, company, etc. Amen. Borelli is a practicing Roman Catholic. Krebs is almost High Anglican, but a holiday churchgoer. Apparently they both closed their eyes and bowed their head during grace, but B peeked. Pavla watched tea throughout, not spart, he said. Fancy meal ensued, lots of courses. Discreet waiters, good wine. Pavla nibbled. Trig invited B and K to query Pavla as they pleased. She stayed cool, frosty. T said she was tired after a long day, but would do her best to cooperate. Borelli thought this odd, but ignored it. He told her that they were attempting parthenogenesis on human subjects and had been working in the lab at this location for several months with the understanding that she'd join them in early February. That didn't happen, apparently because she was not yet convinced to come on board, so Borelli wanted to say up front that he was glad she was finally on the team. She didn't move, didn't blink. Krebs spilled what they knew, that she'd reproduced herself parthenogenetically based on hair samples from her and her baby. She quickly asked Trigliani, what hair samples? He said the ones she provided when they flew together to Rome. From her hairbrush, remember? Pavla clenched her jaw while Krebs launched into their need to discuss her work on maternal centrosomes, meiotic spindles, and the polar body. He went on about skewed brain growth and premature death in parthenogenetically created mice, then how, in the second meiotic division using human ova, they'd reactivated the polar body, but something's wrong in form or perhaps energetics. This is in brackets. Sorry, shop talk, I'll try to limit it, but I think that some of what's happening technically should be on the record. At this point, Trigliani urged Pavla to eat, drink, and enjoy the meal. Krebs boldly said that she might be tired and even unwell, but it was obvious that she was resisting, which he found odd because her work is as proscribed as theirs and far more dangerous and illicit because she'd done what they were only trying to do. That got her talking, angrily. The hair samples, she said, could be genetically identical because they came from the same source, her. Trigliani said that one sample checked out as an infant's, one adult, and that denying what she achieved was less than the cooperation needed for all to benefit from this. Since it wasn't working with them questioning her, Trigliani reversed tactics and invited her to question them. They ate in near silence, just small talk, while Pavla picked at her food, right up to dessert. Then Pavla asked to be excused. Trigliani laughed at that, a question at last, and bluntly said no. Borelli was really squirming by then, but couldn't cut the veneer of nice-nice to ask what was really going on. There was more awkward silence, then Pavla demanded that Trigliani tell how he tracked her. Trigliani said that their paths had crossed while traveling, that he was her knight errant. Then he got vague and said it took a good guess, a little bug, it all worked. What bug, she asked. Then Borelli found his brain and tongue and demanded, what the hell? Pavla said that she was attacked, knocked out, and dragged to this rendezvous, although it was good to be taken alive. That got Borelli screaming, what, for God's sake, is going on? Trigliani said that their supporters wanted her and her baby killed on sight. He made sure she wasn't harmed, although she was not so considerate in return. Apparently she made some quick neck-breaking move on one of her captors, son of a big cheese, rendered him quadriplegic. Now this overlord's demanding that she be reduced to tissue samples. Trigliani's the only one between her being living or frozen meat. He insisted that the baby be unharmed too, and this soft touch resulted in it getting away. That ticked the bosses, and Trigliani said they could be vengeful. Even Krebs was getting perturbed over this. If the neck-broken son died, T said he had orders to kill Pavla immediately, and he wasn't listed as stable at that point. Unless he was certain to live, his father holds the sword. Protecting Pavla from the boss's fury is one of the reasons Trigliani keeps her hidden so well now. Both K and B agreed that the whole setup was an outrage and preposterous, heinous and unscrupulous. Trigliani reminded them that their clandestine work in human parthenogenetic research didn't have them up for sainthood, and if they wanted to continue, there would be risk, danger, comes with the territory. Borelli threw in the towel then, his napkin on the table, and said he wanted out. Trigliani laughed and pulled a handgun from inside his lapel. He pointed it at Borelli and told him to sit down. You can guess that he did. Trigliani warned them that they could work the situation to their advantage and live long lives, achieving fame and fortune, or they could exit at a moment's notice with an obituary in the Daily News. Accidents happen all the time. Or maybe just a complete disappearance. Borelli has been very cooperative since then. Little wonder, too, that he wants me to know everything he and Krebs do, to share the danger, although I'm in deep enough on my own. Pavla's got a little more to bargain with than K, B, and I do. A lot, really. After this gun-waving at the table, she refused to tell anything of her parthenogenetic work, reasoning that she'd be killed whether she divulges or not. She's offering to share some other research she's doing, spin-off stuff, with world recognition guaranteed for the team, kudos for patrons. Plus, it might help them find the Fountain of Youth. She didn't fill them in about this other possibility at the dining table, begging off with a headache, a humdinger, no doubt, after what she'd been through. She promised to tell them the next morning. Trigliani had B and K escorted by gun-toting goons to their quarters. They were free to come and go before then, but Tease said they needed this little reminder that bolting wasn't really an option, as heavy-handed as he's got. Pablo's research and their own ambitions and fears are enough to keep B&K in the chorus line. Borelli guesses that Trigliani saw Pablo to her room. Such a solicitous, opportunistic host. Poor sod, he's the one with Stockholm syndrome for her. Borelli heard a vault-like door close shortly after he got to his own room, probably Pablo being slammed in for the night. Note in Alma's hand. Timing matches Angela's report of P going black. At 8 the next morning, Trigliani and Pavla appeared in the laboratory. Borelli and Krebs were there already, in lab coats, ready to go and eating breakfast from a trolley. She was in a black karate-type uniform, not the gussied-up dress the Trig had arranged for her the night before. He was his usual debonair self, no lab coats for the prince and his lady. Borelli offered her a muffin and coffee. She ate that morning, to his relief, Trigliani's too. Then he announced that the bishop's son, so to speak, was fairly certain to live, but still a mess. Further, he'd thought it over during the night and realized that their bright minds would settle in and work better if any and all questions could be answered, so he said, ask away. Krebs right off wanted to know what sort of mafiosos Trigliani's patrons are. T mumble-mouthed something similar to what he told me, nice big corporation, lots of money, don't bite the hand that feeds you. Borelli asked what Pavla had done to earn their enmity, their wish to destroy her without a trace. Trigliani neatly answered that it was nothing personal, rather the role she plays, what she represents. He said she destabilizes the present and desired world order. He then said something Borelli found fascinating. Trigliani quoted Princess Diana in her famous TV interview, saying that her enemies were, in quotes, the grey men of the palace. He said that there are grey men in far more powerful organizations than mere monarchy, and they order the world as we know it. Just as Diana dared not identify her hitmen, the names she knew or could guess, Pavla Blanca is at the mercy of her own such henchmen. Borelli liked the imagery, but confessed that he still didn't get it. Trigliani told him that he never would, so stop wasting his time thinking about it. They were there to do science, and this glimmer of the inner workings of the bigger world is tangential and inconsequential. They have a golden opportunity to further their own goals, maybe even win a Nobel Prize for it, if Pavla's research panned out. Better than pointless death, Trigliani said. Borelli was still fighting, wondering how they could work under such constraints when he thought they were going to be a willing congress of like minds meeting freely. Trigliani assured him that there's no such thing, not at any level. Not if it matters, and their work would matter. Focus on that. Pablo suggested that since they had a lot of ground to cover, they should get down to work. T liked that a lot, his no-nonsense kind of woman. She led us to the lab's whiteboard and said that she would share her research on her immune system with far superior resistance than the average humans. Her studies are preliminary, but indicate that the mitochondrial elements we all share from a common matrilineal source can be made to mimic a nuclear DNA-RNA process requisite for human parthenogenetic reproduction, a process that leading researchers are yet to discover. In parentheses, here comes the jargon, bear with me or skip into parentheses. She's got proof that this nuclear process serves to correct, for example, the skewed brain growth of parthenogenetically produced mice. And it also confers, as an apparent byproduct, an a priori immunity to nearly every disease and condition induced by foreign agents, including the ability to chelate or otherwise denature and excrete a wide spectrum of oxidants and toxins. It plays a role in healing as well, tissue regeneration, which holds hope for curing all sorts of injuries, including severed spinal cords. For example, a spin-off benefit might be something that gets the quad goon walking again. Smart move on her part. The P.O. dad had better keep her alive. She's his best hope to get his boy on his feet again. She told us that the work would be hard and it would take years, even going all out as a team. Getting the more basic, immutable, and singularly dedicated mitochondrial DNA to take on a subtle and complex function of a mutant nuclear DNA-RNA process conferred during parthenogenetic meiosis could prove insurmountable, although she says she's worked out several possible means and mechanisms which, by close study, experimentation, and refinement, might reveal step by step how to make this giant leap. Pablo's ace is that she's miles ahead of B&K in this research, and she's promised she'll keep a healthy lead. Their position would be to help solve problems with the bits and pieces of her research, while she'll mind the tie-in mechanisms and big picture, which they wouldn't likely know or guess without her inside knowledge. Luckily, she shared enough with me so I could bargain my way in, although she's a long way ahead of my inklings. Kay asked how they'd win the Nobel when she held and withheld the winning cards as she pleased. Pavla said that they'd negotiate, that things would change. They always do. They'd publish jointly with her as Janet McElroy, and everyone listed alphabetically so they'd get credit along the way. Then she asked if they should start at the kindergarten level of her studies and work toward graduation, or they should argue about the color of caps and gowns right off. She scored more points with Trigliani for that. B2. T said, "Get on with kindergarten," and she went into detail. Forgive the jargon again, important stuff to replication nuts. We'll spend the first year or two reviewing normal meiotic functions and the replication of mitochondria because they're so imperfectly understood at key junctures that even this preliminary work will be groundbreaking. After they've solved these little riddles, they'll fine-tune their understanding of parthenogenetic meiosis and naturally occurring and induced models across a wide variety of species. This is the springboard from which they can launch their understanding of Pavla's mutated expression with its attendant immunosuperiority, leading to the next step, how Pavla's normal nuclear division differs sufficiently to confer lifelong protection. Typical specimens don't have this, but mitochondrial replication from the pure maternal line holds promise. The quantum leap to inducing and controlling this ability in typical mitochondrial specimens up to and including human, well, it's possible, it's probable, and it can be done. She concluded kindergarten lesson one by asking if they were ready for step one, which was introducing her to the laboratory equipment and provision possibilities in case they had to order or make some unique supplies. That's when Trigliani said B and K would continue working both at that lab and their own facilities, but Pavla wouldn't be working there, to her surprise. She's going to direct them from a remote location, not on any map, incommunicado with anyone but him. No unusual means of communication either, don't even dream it. T leaned on the word dream. The word dream is underlined. Borelli noted that it made Pavla wince, but added, why wouldn't a prisoner dream of every possible way to communicate and escape? Trigliani said that she'd be comfortable, safe, and as productive as she wished to be. She didn't question or protest the arrangements. She just picked up some markers and started filling the whiteboard with diagrams and equations to illustrate preliminary aspects of her DNA-RNA studies, the writing I saw when I visited the lab. Section 3. Postscript. Trigliani says he told B and K that Pavla's mother was born in Nepal in Lumbini, Buddha's birthplace. Her grandmother was born at Delphi, and her great-grandmother was born in Haida Gwaii in a sacred spot. Her daughter Luna was born at Pipestone National Monument in Minnesota. Trig gave me a copy of the following, which he also gave to B and K. A story of Lakota origin says that the first pipe was brought to the ancestors of white buffalo calf woman, a messenger from the Great Spirit, thus forming a link between those on earth and the spirit world. She taught them that the pipe, the bowl engraved with a buffalo calf, joins land and sky, and its smoke carries messages to the Great Spirit. She showed them how to pray with the pipe, how to decorate themselves when praying to Mother Earth, and above all else, to use it as a peace pipe to be smoked before all ceremonies. She taught them the seven sacred rites, including the Inipi, the Cleansing Sweat Lodge, the Wiwanyak Wachipi, the Sun Dance of Thanksgiving, Ishuatua Awikalawan, the ceremony to prepare a girl for womanhood. In this last ritual, the girl is honored like a towering tree. She is the source of strength and, like the Mother Earth, will bear children, raising them in a spiritual way. Oh, Luna, Fran sighed heavily as she finished reading Michelle's report and rose to file it in Maya's old room in Pavla's dresser drawer. Sweet babe, white buffalo calf woman, tall order. Fran found Maya's drawer, the bottom one of four. Notes and photographs filled it to the brim. She took a cursory look through the neat stacks of paper, some of it in May's handwriting, but much of it in what Fran guessed to be Maya's hand. They had worked very small to fit a long and spectacular lifetime into a single drawer. The latest pile sat on the right, the earliest began on the bottom left. Fran took the leftmost stack, about a foot deep, and placed it beside her. She would start reading and scanning from Maya's birth, since that would likely best serve her biographer, whomever that might be, and whenever that top priority work got underway. Fran closed Maya's drawer and opened the next one up, three-quarters full of notes about and by Alma. Fran flipped through a few pages. The handwriting was also nicely compact. Kavla's drawer was half full with the same Spartan use of paper. Rochelle's report would go in there, but Fran would scan it onto a slim hard drive, which would eventually hold all of Pavla's papers. Or maybe she thought microfilm would be better for copies, because they could always be read with low-tech magnifying power. Future computers may not be able to read old e-files that hadn't been updated regularly, or electricity itself might vanish from the world. Not such a far-fetched possibility given the shifting magnetic poles and vast solar storms like the 1859 Carrington event. Fran hadn't covered the science beat, but some of those who did kept her filled in. Yes, Fran muttered, she'd start by putting everything on microfilm. Down the road, she might have an assistant to help to convert them to text files. Figuring out the approach and process by which to tackle the unimaginably huge task ahead helped clear her mind. Fran looked through Luna's nearly empty top drawer, which had photos of her at Pipestone, including a copy of the one Pavla had shown Maya in Jeddah. A note explained Luna Blanca as the obvious white moon, linked to Evrope, meaning true or open, full face, the goddess Europe, said Europe, one of many Western world names for iconic women in her fertile, fruitful phase. One of their line was doubtless the first real woman named Evrope, Europe, Europe. But that file wasn't in the drawer. Fran made a mental note to keep an eye out for it in May's vast work. So far to go, little one, Fran said. So much depending on me and Nikos and all the luck in the world. Fran backtracked to look through Pavla's accomplishments and photos, but her eyes were swimming with tears, and her head was too full to take in another scintilla of information. She put Rochelle's report in the drawer for now, shut it tight, and left the bedroom, closing the door behind her. As she locked the front door, leaving May's house of muses and mysteries, she muttered, "Tomorrow, just another day."